All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Mindful Hunter podcast. I'm your host, as always, Jay Nickel. And today we are going to do a wrap-up video to my Saskatchewan archery whitetail hunt, which was guided. And there's a bunch of really interesting things that we can talk about. We can talk about the fact that it was a guided hunt. We can talk about the fact that a bow blew up in my hand. We can talk about the fact that I saw more deer in 1 week than I've ever seen in my entire life. So we're going to dive into all of that. However, before we do, a little bit of housekeeping. So I just launched my Hoyt RX7 review. So I'll get into the details as this story kind of progresses about what happened. But essentially, I've been meaning to do a review for my RX7 for quite some time. And when it blew up in my hands, which we will get into, on this hunt, I was like, well, now's the time for the review. So I posted the review. And while I was making the review, I thought to myself, you know, it's unlike me to do a single product review. I like to do comparisons. I like a way to be able to, you know, talk about relative performance and other characteristics that you can only do when you compare multiple products against each other. So I thought to myself, I need to do a big bow review, but how do I do this and how do I make it interesting and valuable for the community? So here's what I decided to do. I am going to do a 6 month long aluminum riser compound bow review. I'm going to buy one bow per month. I'm going to use it for a whole month and I'll review it at the end of the month. I'll set all the bows up from scratch, tune them, shoot them, get them broadhead tuned, the whole nine yards. And then at the end of each of those reviews, I will raffle off that bow, which should theoretically still be in brand new condition because I'm not going to take them hunting. I'm just going to shoot them at the range and at the house, and I'll keep them nice and clean and in really good shape. And I can even set them up for whatever specs the winner wants. However, to kick that review series off, I was like, well, if I'm going to be looking at new bows, I think it's pretty exciting for you guys to get to look at new bows. So today, well, actually, this is going to go up on Thursday. So yesterday on Wednesday, I launched the Win the Bow of Your Dreams raffle. So you can buy tickets at mindful-reviews.com. If you win, you can choose any aluminum riser bow of your choice, and I'm going to include $500 for accessories. So you can buy a rest and a sight, or if you've got a rest and a sight and you want to build some new arrows with that money, you do whatever you want. The $500 is yours to spend however you please. The response has been overwhelming. The amount of views on my review have absolutely destroyed any of my other. It's over 1,000 views in the first 3 hours, and that's just pretty wild. Like, I do not have a gigantic YouTube channel, so that's by far the most popular review I've ever posted. But I guess it's pretty, you know, sensational when a bow blows up in your hand and you miss the biggest whitetail of your life. So I assume this raffle is going to go pretty quick. There was only 125 tickets available. And I think as of 5 minutes ago, there was 75 or 80 tickets left. So if you want in on that, get in on that. If you're a member at Mindful Reviews, I right now have a poll up with maybe 11 or 12 bows that are all in contention to be one of the six that are going to get reviewed. Log in, get your vote registered, and let's get this party started. I want to order the first bow next week. So I'm going to leave this post up for a few days, and then I'll make a decision this weekend about what the six final bows will be. So yeah, check out that YouTube video, check out the raffle if you're interested. And I'm going to do what I can to kind of bring my own. I talk about this in the video, but the reason I've never done a bow review is that A, I thought other people were more qualified. And B, bows are really expensive. So how I ever thought I was going to be able to put my hands on multiple bows was a bit of a friction point. But after looking at all the other reviews, two things occurred to me. One, most of these bow guys are sponsored, except for guys like Inside Out Precision or Podium Archer, who I think are, you know, phenomenal reviewers. And I, you know, definitely can't replace or, you know, what they do. But, you know, guys like Dudley and Elk Shape, I think they offer a lot to the community, but one's sponsored by PSC and one's sponsored by Matthews. Like those guys will never give you a comprehensive overview of the market, nor should they, you know, and I don't begrudge them that. That's how the economy or the economics of the content creator marketplace work. So after looking around, I thought to myself, also, a lot of those reviews tend to be super technical, and you need like a degree in physics to understand what John Dudley's talking about half the time. So I thought what I could do is something a little more palatable for the middle of the road guy or the person just getting into it that wants some usable technical information on which bow might be best for them. It's a lot of money to invest. So we're going to kick off this series. I'll do the best I'm capable of doing, as I always try to do. And yeah, come along for the ride. I think it's going to be fun. Okay, so let's talk about this hunt a little bit. A little bit of background on my whitetail experience. So the very first time I ever hunted whitetail, I was in Montana on a guided archery elk hunt way back, like 2018, I think. Yeah, almost 6 years ago now. And we had a down afternoon due to weather. So he's like, you can go sit in a stand for whitetail if you want. So I went and sat in a stand for whitetail, and it was like just a blast, man. Like I had them walking underneath me and stuff. Never got a shot at one, but it really sparked that interest. So the next year, I went on a guided whitetail meat hunt in BC near Rock Creek. It was like a couple grand. You were allowed to shoot a doe and a buck if you could find one. I shot a doe. No bucks came out. It was only a three-day hunt. And you notice there's this trend. It's always guided hunts with whitetail. There's not a lot of whitetail close to home. And the whole point is I wanted to tree stand hunt. And I don't really know any areas to tree stand hunt that are within a drive to home. I didn't have any of the equipment. And so it started turning into my fun hunt of the year. Like I do a lot of these like ball busting, back breaking, hardcore backcountry hunts. And like every now and then you just want to go have some fun. You know, bear hunting is like that for me. I love going up to Landers. It's chill. Go sit in some fields, look at some railroad tracks. You don't really start hunting till 3 p.m. I mean, yeah. Now, listen, sitting in a stand at minus 15 for 11 straight hours might not be most ideas people of fun, but I legitimately love it. So the combination of just wanting to kind of take the thought process out of it and not really having access to tree stand huntable terrain or all the gear, I just kept doing these guided whitetail hunts. And then last year I did one in Alberta, didn't really see too much, kind of a couple glitches with that hunt, but it was still a great learning experience. And then this year, I wanted to go somewhere where I was going to see a lot of deer, and because I'm using archery gear, I wanted someplace that was able to bait, because I really wanted the, you know, the best shot opportunity possible, and I wanted some time to like look at the deer and decide if it was the one I wanted. And so I decided to go to Saskatchewan. And at first, not really understanding what a whitetail mecca Saskatchewan is, like having met a bunch of Americans at hunt camp in Saskatchewan, like, that's their Valhalla, man. Like for the true whitetail nut, like Saskatchewan is it. Like, and I wasn't really aware of what we had in our kind of backyard. So I booked this hunt last year. It was a guided hunt, and I got a bunch of questions about cost and stuff. And I feel like, I don't want to say there's an elitism around guided hunts, but the people who were asking me about costs were kind of doing it in this like, oh, it must be nice to afford that kind of way. And I was like, I mean, I don't mean to be a dick, but if you can't afford, like, this is not a grizzly bear hunt in Alaska. It's not a Marco Polo hunt in Tajikistan or wherever the heck those things happen. Like, it was $6,000 US. And I don't mean to be a dick, but if you can't come up with $6,000 to go do the thing that you're most passionate about in life, you probably need to give your head a shake. I've taken flack on this before, but I think, like, I come from nothing. I come from less than nothing. And I, through hard work and discipline, have built my life to a place where if I want to go on a guided hunt, I'll go on a guided hunt. It's like, I don't even really have to ask my wife about it. Like I go and spend the money. So my advice to these people who get kind of bent out of shape at people doing guided hunts is just like, I would take a look at your own priorities, because there's probably some latent resentment there for where you're at in life that you are kind of pointing at other people. I personally don't give a shit. Now, I do have a frustration when people kind of tout a guided hunt as being the same level of challenge as a regular hunt. Like, I always, if a hunt was guided and I post a picture, I always put it in the description. I'm always very hesitant to like, oh, this one was a real grind. Cause it's like, let's be honest. Like, you're showing up, somebody else has done the homework. And that's why I refer to these hunts as my fun hunts. Like, I know what they are. They're a hunt where somebody else has done the majority of the legwork up front, and I get to show up and reap the benefits because I'm willing to give them some cash. Now, that doesn't mean it's a slam dunk. It doesn't mean there isn't some challenge inherent in it. It doesn't mean it can't be super enjoyable. And for dudes who are super busy and make tons of cash and don't have, you know, the priorities are different in their life, like, and they go do these big sheep hunts, I hold nothing, like, fill your boots, man. I think it's great. I think it feeds the economy. I think it gives guides jobs. I think I still respect what you did. I think it's fantastic. The only caveat for me is that, like, don't hold out your guided animal as if it was a DIY animal, because those two things are different accomplishments in my opinion. And if your opinion differs from that, you're more than welcome to it. So again, the hunt was technically $6,600, which is actually pretty affordable for a Saskatchewan whitetail hunt. I've seen them as high as $8,000 and $9,000. Like, if you go with some of the bigger outfits that have been around for a long time and have a big history of trophy animals, you're probably looking at like $8,000 or $9,000, which, I will be honest, like, even $6,600, after spending that money this year, I don't think I will be doing that again. In fact, as a Canadian resident, you can apply for a Saskatchewan whitetail tag. It's a draw. And after seeing kind of the density of the animal and how the crown land is over there, that's what I'm going to do next year. I'm just going to put in for the draw, and I'm going to drive out myself, go to the feed mill, buy a bunch of alfalfa and a bunch of bags of grain. And I will specifically not go anywhere near the region where this outfitter was. He was a great outfitter. Chaparral Hunting Adventures, Greg Lavoie, awesome guy, awesome camp. I'll get into all those details. But out of respect, I never go back to an area where I have been with a guided hunter by myself. The only exception being Lander's territory, and that's because he's personally invited me up there to hunt when there's not hunters around, and I don't go in his actual tenure. I go on the kind of outskirts of it where his hunters wouldn't be allowed to hunt anyways, but I can because I'm a BC resident. So there's crown land kind of adjacent to his tenure that nobody really gets a chance to hunt that I, you know, when he invites me, I go up and hunt. And that's the only exception to that rule. I feel very strongly about that. I think that's a dick move if you get somebody to, and that's why BC guides are hesitant to have BC clients, because you can go back and hunt their terrain. And I don't, hold them. I have no problems with that opinion. I think it's probably a safer bet just to not have BC clients. So anyways, I booked the hunt last year. Didn't really know what to expect. Show up. Now, they do something very interesting where they draw for stands. So he runs something like 35 stands throughout the year. He's got 60 cameras. He baits 35 stands. In camp, there was 7 hunters for my week. So the night before the first hunt, everybody gets together in the living room, and he's picked based on pictures and activity and all that kind of stuff and what he saw the previous week. He picks what he thinks are the best 7 stands, and then he puts them in a hat, and you draw your stand, and that's your stand for the week. Now, you have to stick in that stand for the first 3 days. It was a 6-day hunt. After the third day, if you're not liking what you're seeing anybody, as of that, at the end of each day, if you want a new stand, whoever wants a new stand, however many people, he puts that many new stands in the hat and you pull for it. So I did end up switching stands twice, which I'll get into. But the only kind of, it wasn't even necessarily a drawback, but an interesting piece of information is that he's primarily set up for rifle. So he has these homemade tree stands that are like badass, like double wide. He hoists them up with a block and tackle and a side by side. They're super nice, but they're all, you know, 75 to 125 yards away from the baits. And so they're not suitable for bow hunting. So basically he had to go out and whatever stand I drew, he'd have to go out and set up for bow hunting. And on two occasions, that was with a tree stand. And on one occasion it was with a blind. And actually that was only because I went to go in the tree stand and there was literally 65 kilometer an hour gusting winds. And after sitting up there, shitting my pants for an hour and a half, I was like, no, we're done, bro. I'm coming down. Bring me a ground blind. I'm hunting, but I ain't hunting up here. But he uses tree climbers. So for people who are not familiar with tree stands, there's kind of, I don't know, a few different categories of tree stands. One that is the simplest to explain is a ladder stand. It is essentially a ladder with a platform at the top. You lean it against the tree, you ratchet strap it to the tree, you climb up the ladder and sit in the platform. Simple. Then you have like kind of super lightweight hang-on stands. These would be like lone wolf style stands with a flip down seat and a flip down platform. They're ultra light. You can use climbing sticks or tree screw-in tree steps to get yourself up the tree, put them on with either a chain or a ratchet strap. Super exposed, super freaky, you know, for people who are into heights. And then you kind of got this one in the middle like a climber. I'm not going to get into the mechanics of how you can use it to actually climb the tree, but it's basically two pieces, a platform you stand on and a platform you sit on, and you can kind of like work the two pieces biting the tree up the tree and use it to climb the tree. But he did not use the climbers to actually climb the tree. He has these ladders that he attaches to the tree, and then he just pulls the climbers up and attaches them to the tree. I really liked the climbers. And I'm sharing this because if you've only gone stand hunting a couple times or not at all, and the idea of being super exposed on a hang-on minimalist stand is spooky for you, I would urge you to look at these climbers because they have a bar around where you're sitting that you put your hands on that offers some visual sense of security. The platforms are a little bit bigger. They're not quite as lightweight. There are some very interesting lightweight ones. The one I'm looking at right now is called an Olman, Olman, Alumalite. And it looks like a really nice stand that's not crazy heavy. And I think I'm going to buy one for next year. I bought a Novix Echo for this year because I started experimenting with my own tree stand hunting. Anyways, he had these climbers. I really liked these climbers. When you do this hunt in Saskatchewan, it's an all-day sit. So you leave camp around, let's say 7 a.m. You get to your stand for 7:30. It gets light around 8:30, and you normally leave around 6. So you're in the stand for somewhere between 10 and a half and 11 hours. And in these little stands, I mean, it's challenging. It is more interesting because there's so many deer, and the weather was quite moderate this year. So it wasn't too bad. I really had a blast. And in fact, I'm going through hardcore tree stand withdrawal right now. And I think I've finally narrowed it down. The thing that attracts me to backcountry hunting is the simplicity and the purity of it. When you wake up in the morning, you have one thing on your mind. How am I going to find and kill an animal? And nothing else exists. Your family doesn't exist. Your bills don't exist. Your house doesn't exist. Your job doesn't exist. Just finding and killing this animal is the only thing that exists. And that simplicity of purpose is addictive. When you're in a tree stand, it's the same way. Almost it's amplified though, because you are so still and you are paying so much attention and you are listening so intently for the slightest noise. And then when they do come, you have to be so still so they don't bust you, that it's almost even a more intensified version of that. And when you do that for a week straight and you leave, it's really challenging. I was kind of depressed the first couple of days when I get home. I was like, man, I just want to go sit in a tree stand. Like, it's so simple. Like, I love it. So get there, draw the stands, do the do, head out on the first morning, get up in my tree, and like instantly there's deer. There's deer on the bait while I'm going up in the tree stand. And then my guide, Steve, who's like passing me my backpack and stuff, we're kind of whispering to each other and literally looking at deer 30 yards away while we're doing this. Like, I was just like, this place is crazy. And they basically have big alfalfa piles at each of the baits. And then they usually top it up with some grain every morning to kind of lure the deer in. Now, I want to say, this is not a slam dunk way to hunt at all. While you will look at does all day, no problem using this method, it is definitely not foolproof to get big bucks to come in. And in fact, a lot of the big bucks steer clear of the bait piles. Some people prefer to natural hunt because they actually think the odds are better of seeing one of the big bucks, because the bait piles for them are these things that they are concerned about. And one of the issues we had, so there's like different phases of the whitetail rut. And again, I'm not an expert, so I'm just going to share what has been shared with me. But unfortunately, for most of our hunt, we were in what's called lockdown. So lockdown is the kind of the part of the middle of the rut where the big bucks, the old bucks, have found their does and they go hide out with them for 3, 4, 6 days, who knows. And during that lockdown, they're just breeding them and you don't see any big bucks. Like, it was crazy to see. So there was a 140 inch limit on, let's talk about that right now, and then I'll get back into the kind of lockdown phase, because this was a big learning for me. So there was a 140 inch limit at camp, which means if you shot a deer under 140 inches, you were fined $1,000. And if you did that 2 years in a row, you would be asked to never come back. Greg has a very firm vision for what he wants his property to be. Now, on one hand, I was super cool with this. On the other hand, I was really frustrated by this. So when he told me about it originally on the phone a year ago, I don't know whitetail scoring. I was like 140 inch buck. In mule deer terms, that's just like a relatively decent buck. It's nothing crazy. And so I was thinking to myself, okay, as long as I don't shoot a dink, I'll be all right. It turns out when I get there, like 140 inch whitetail is like a massive whitetail by any reasonable individual standards. Like, a guy shot a 149 and I'm holding this rack and I'm just like, this thing is gargantuan. And so I never personally saw a buck over 130 inches the entire time. So my frustration that I had, he's also hunting on public land, so there's other people that can kill these bucks. So while I support his decision to have a limit, I don't think I will go back to another place that has a limit unless there's some type of qualifications. So it's like, listen, I don't mind holding out, but if you're telling me I'm going to come and I'm going to not see a single animal that's over your imposed limit my entire hunt when I've paid to be there, I kind of have an issue with that, because it's like, to me, then your limit is too high. Like, I'm not paying to increase the size of your herd. Like, that's not fair. You should, you know, have a half price hunt or something like that, if that's what you want to do. And one could argue, you know, a $6,600 hunt in Saskatchewan is somewhat of a discount. And again, I don't hold this against Greg. This was a learning for me. I agreed to it, so I upheld it. And, but it also feels like when you hold out for an animal, there's this sense of personal achievement. Like, I saw a smaller buck go by and I let him go because I'm going to exercise the discipline to wait for something bigger. But when you're only waiting for something bigger because you've made an agreement, a business transaction with another man to not shoot something smaller, it's like, well, I'm not exercising any discipline. I'm just following the rules. And it kind of takes away from that sense of personal achievement. And also, I really believe, like, hunters should shoot what excites them. You know, like, I've seen people posting pictures of like tiny bucks lately. but they're new to hunting. It was super exciting. They're glad to shoot it. It's a legal buck. I'm like, fill your boots, man. Have a good time. And there were bucks that, especially because I was using a bow, there were bucks I saw routinely that I would have been ecstatic to take home. And I wasn't allowed to shoot those bucks. So it was a little bit frustrating. One guy in camp did shoot a buck under 140, and he shot it on purpose. Like, he was talking about the buck before he shot it. He'd seen it 3 days in a row, and he knew it was under 140, and he decided to shoot it under 140. And it didn't go over well, man. Like, Greg wasn't happy, and you could see the disappointment in the hunter. Like, he'd let himself down. He let Greg down. It was like a bit of a downer night in camp. Like, so that was another big takeaway for me, because I had kind of thought the limit was more kind of like, you could break it if you want to, when I agreed to it. Like, listen, you're going to have to pay $1,000 if you shoot a buck under 140. But like, if you want to take one home, just make sure your check clears, you know? Like, I thought it was more of like a lighthearted, like a swear jar type of fine. But when I showed up, it was like, oh no, this is like, you do not shoot a buck under 140. And if for some reason you accidentally do, you're going to be fined. So that was a big learning for me. I would go in with guidelines on a hunt. Like, listen, we don't want you to shoot anything, you know, younger, 3.5 years or younger. Do your best. But listen, if by day five, you've only seen 3.5 year bucks, you know, go nuts, kill one. I would be open to something like that. Like, you still want to bring something home on a hunt like that. But anyways, so back to lockdown. So the week before we showed up, he's got pictures of like 140s, 150s, like buck. And then as soon as it comes to our week, they are just ghosted. They're not showing up at night. They're not showing up in the day. And they're in this lockdown phase. And we're all looking at 125 and 130 inch bucks. And, you know, everybody's seeing 2, 3, 4, 5 of these a day. You're seeing 5, 10, 15 does, like pretty steady action for most people, most days. And the days kind of roll into each other. Like, there's not a lot to talk about the hunt. Like, you wake up, you go have breakfast, great cook, great food. You pick up your lunch, you get in the side-by-side, or I rode a quad. You ride to your stand, you sit there all day, you come home, you have dinner, you know, shoot the shit with everybody in the living room for a couple hours, go to bed and rinse and repeat. Like, it's a very relaxing, fun hunt for people who are into stand hunting. Like, it's a blast. Really good people, really good food, great accommodations. Like, it was, I don't have a single bad thing to say. Like, it was, other than my own personal frustrations with that limit. And again, I agreed to it. I respect it. I lived up to it. So I sat in my stand for the first 3 days. Then he gave me the opportunity to switch. I still felt like I'm seeing a lot of action. My stand's really set up well for archery. I'm going to stick it out for day four. And then didn't see much day four. And then at the end of day four, we're back at camp and he kind of brings up, he's like, listen, I don't normally do this, but I have a cull buck. There's like a 130 type buck that has no brow tines, no G1s. It's 3x3. And it's a pretty big frame, probably 3.5 year old, 4.5 year old deer. I don't want him in the breeding population because of the lack of G1s. He doesn't want, you know, small scoring deer like that to get into the gene pool. He's like, if somebody wants to go shoot this deer, there'll be no fine. There'll be no hard feelings. It would, you know, I'd appreciate it. Go shoot this deer. And like, nobody else was into it. So I was like, I will go shoot this deer. Like, I'm not even remotely opposed to shooting this deer. So he puts me in the stand where the deer had been showing up. That was the day we had to move from the stand to the blind. So I lost a few hours, but you know, that's the other thing. Like I was up there and I'm like, listen, man, can you bring me a ground blind? And I was kind of like in a stand that was in the middle of nowhere and zero hesitation, zero negative feelings. He was like, on my way, man, set me up an awesome ground blind super fast. Like by noon I was back hunting. It was great. And so I hunt this location for 2 days. First day, I don't see, we called him Slick, this deer with no G1. So first day, no Slick, but I'm seeing like nice deer. Like the nice, it was a 9 point. It was the nicest deer I'd seen. I got pictures of him on my Instagram. He's the nicest deer I saw the whole time. Like he's probably like a 130-ish type buck. Again, like a wall hanger anywhere else in the world, like a beautiful, and the size of the body. So a guy there killed a 149 and his body weighed 275 pounds. Like these deer are monstrous whitetails. Like they're huge. Even the 134 that the guy shot was 205 pounds, 3.5-year-old deer. The 275 pound deer was an 8.5-year-old deer. Like when they came walking by the ground blind, I could feel the steps on the ground. Like I was just like, wow. So I was looking at this 9 point for both days. I would have loved to have shot the 9 point, but again, it was under the limit. So I sit there for the whole 2 days, nothing. And then finally, 2:30 in the afternoon, last day, Slick comes walking in. And I'm like, holy shit. And man, did I get jacked up. Way too jacked up. That's something else about stand hunting. This, I don't get affected like this. Like when you're doing spot and stalk, you have time to get accustomed to the fact that you're going to go shoot this animal. When you're elk hunting, things happen so fast, you don't really have time to get nervous. When you're stand hunting, it's like the perfect combination of both of the negative parts of that. It's like you can see the animal coming, but not so long that you can calm yourself down. Like you've got to shoot right. Anyways, the nerves that hit you tree stand hunting are the worst nerves that have ever hit me. And it's been that time, that way, every time a buck has come in when I've been in the tree stand. It's one of my notes for the off season that I got to work on. I'm going to do some like box breathing exercises and have a couple of like systems in place so that as bucks come in, I'm on top of, you know, my heart rate and my shaking and all that kind of stuff. So I'm jacked. I'm like, holy shit, man. 6 days out in the winter, sitting in stands, 11 hours a day, and Slick just showed up. I'm like, holy shit. And the funny part about it was all these other bucks that have been coming in, I was sitting in this ground blind again, couldn't have cared less about the ground blind. As soon as Slick comes in, bam, he's on to me. And I'm just like, there's some sixth sense. Like these other deer knew I couldn't shoot them. So they just didn't care. And I think Slick knew like, oh, I've got some juju here. Like somebody wants to take a poke at me. And so I had everything set up in the ground blind. I wait for him to do his thing. It is not ideal. He doesn't come right into the bait. But he ends up standing broadside behind the bait. So it's a 30-yard shot, which for me is a slam dunk. Like, I could do that shot with my eyes closed. So I'm in the ground blind. I'm in a nice chair. Angle's good. Clothing's good. Bow's good. Everything's great. He's looking at me. But these are not like tiny whitetail that are going to duck a string. Like, this thing is like the size of like a half an elk. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm not worried that he's going to see me shoot the bow. He's not going anywhere. Come back to full draw. Anchor. Look through my peep. Get my sight picture. He's still. I'm still. Everything's still. Take a couple breaths. And then pull. My shot sequence. Bang. Arrow breaks. My shot breaks. Arrow gets released. And then all hell breaks loose. Crash! This like explosive sound in the blind. The bow kind of flies to one side. I feel it get pulled towards the ground. I see the buck run. I don't see where my arrow went. I don't hear where how the arrow hit. I am like, what the fuck just happened? And I immediately think to myself, I've just dry fired a bow. So I've done that once before. Blew the bow up. You only need to do that once. And I think to myself, I just dry fired the bow. I look down at my quiver. I'm like, no, there's only 5 arrows. I shot an arrow. And I mean, I vividly remember looking at my broadhead on the end of my rest. Like, I did not dry fire the bowl, but that was just the first thing that came into my head. And then I look down and my rest is hanging off of the cord on the limb. And I'm like, it takes a minute to process it. And the first thing that I think of is my rest just blew apart. I used to run QAD and I went through like a bad QAD once where kind of like a year into it, it used to like get stuck. And I had a couple of bad experiences where like an arrow got jammed because the rest didn't lower. So I'm not unfamiliar with what happens when a rest doesn't operate effectively. And I think to myself like, oh, my rest is just screwed up. And because the arrow slammed into it, it like knocked it apart or something like that. And I'm like, so I wait a couple minutes and then I get out of the blind and I'm looking down at this thing and I immediately text. So Kellen, Inside Out Precision, used to work at the bow rack, is now at G4. Awesome guy, super knowledgeable. He built the bow. I immediately text him a picture. I'm like, dude, what just happened, man? I was like, I just tried to shoot the biggest whitetail of my life and my bow blew, my rest blew apart. That's what I said in the text. And within 5 minutes, he texts me back and he's like, dude, I've never seen this before in my life. The rest didn't blow apart. The insert that is epoxied onto the bow that the rest attaches to completely blew off the bow. So with carbon fiber bows, you can't screw into carbon fiber. So what they do when they mold the carbon fiber, they leave these little molded parts where the inserts go. And if you need to screw something to a bow, they epoxy these like inserts that have nutserts in them onto the side of the bow. And then you screw into that insert. And that entire thing came off and I can see the epoxy. And in fact, there's not even that much of it. And I think it was either epoxy that was inappropriately applied or there was some type of defect with the epoxy itself, because there is just no rational explanation in the world for why this insert would fly off the bow the way that it did. So we'll get back to the bow in a minute. So I'm still like, I don't know what happened. I don't know. And I normally wear a GoPro, but this was my fun hunt of the year. I'm not filming. I'm having fun. I'm enjoying myself. I'm being present. So I don't have a GoPro on. So I walk over to the bait. First, I text Greg. I'm like, listen, you need to get out here and you need to bring me my rifle. Because even if I have an injured buck, I can't go after him right now because I can't shoot my bow. So if I get into the situation where I need to do a follow-up shot, I'm not going to be able to. He's like, okay, on my way. So I start looking around the bait. I looked around the bait for 45 minutes at least, and I could not find my arrow, which is like not necessarily a sign that you hit him. Like, listen, I've lost arrows at the archery range where it's like, I know where that arrow went in the grass and it just gets buried in the grass or goes in the dirt. Or so like the lack of an arrow is not concrete evidence that your arrow is buried in the animal. But it's kind of like, because I thought I just missed him. I thought there's no way with what just happened to that bow that I hit this deer. So I'm looking and looking and looking. And finally, it's been like an hour and 15 minutes since I shot at the deer. And I decide to start walking around in these like bigger circles. And there's some like, I know where the deer ran and there's like a path and some open areas. And so I feel comfortable starting to branch out my search a little bit without the gun. And it's been long enough now. So I start walking around and after about 20 minutes, 50 yards away from where I shot the deer, I find blood. And decent blood, like a dinner plate size patch to like a small, more like a serving plate. You know, like 8-inch circles, 2 8-inch circles, but it's not heavy. And it's pretty bright. There's no bubbles and it's not dark. So I know it's not liver blood. I know it's not lung blood, but it's a little bit of blood. Like it's significant. I'm like, okay, I hit this deer. So Greg shows up, grab the rifle. We start blood trailing the deer. We blood trail the deer for a total of 330 yards. After 250 yards, we find my arrow. And it's got blood on it. It was clearly a pass-through of some kind. So I'm actually pretty excited at this point. I'm like, I don't know how you get a pass-through on a deer and it goes 250 yards and you don't end up with a dead deer. But I'm still like, this is really thick terrain. It's possible that he could be dead and we're just not going to find him. So the other thing was there was coagulated blood on the veins, which I learned later is not a great sign. I don't think arterial blood coagulates. I think it's an enzyme in the muscle fiber that makes it coagulate. At least that's what this French guy at camp was trying to explain to me. And so, because when he said that coagulated blood, he's like, this is a muscle shot of some kind. And I'm going to circle back to that. So we track him for another 80 yards to get to 330 total. And it's getting dark. And we decide to pull out. It's very cold this time of year. And so we're thinking nothing's going to happen to the meat overnight. Maybe we'll get some help from the coyotes or the birds in the morning. So we pull out, we go back to camp. Obviously have one of those shit nights where you're just like, what a shit show, man. Showing everybody my bow. Everybody's like, this is crazy. Kellen is trying to do whatever he can with Hoyt to figure out what the warranty process is with this at this point in time. So the hunt's over. That was the last day. So everybody leaves for the airport the next morning. Me and Greg, the owner, go back out. We blood trail for most of the day. We followed that deer for almost a mile before we lost him. The blood trail was almost non-existent by the end. I don't even know how we were finding what we were finding. It was crazy because most of the snow had melted. So we were getting like single blood drops, 10, 15 yards apart. Like there's tracks everywhere because there's so much deer back there. And here's my final assessment. Obviously, this is speculation, but it's the best explanation I've got. I think because he was broadside, but he was kind of quartering to me. And because the rest came off shooter's right side of the bow, it would have kicked the nock to the right, kicking the broadhead to the left, which the way the buck was broadside and quartering to me would have sent the arrow towards the back of the deer. And I think what happened is I got a pass through on the back half of a single hindquarter without severing the femoral artery, and that it was kind of stuck in that back chunk of meat for a couple hundred yards, and then it worked itself free when he was going through the really thick brush. Another data point is that he never once bedded down in almost a mile. He never once bedded down, and it looked like all of the blood that we found, even up to that mile point, was from the day before. It was like he didn't stop at all. After he shot, he did that whole mile and whatever else he went and did. So the fact that the blood dried up the way it did, the fact that there was never like any big pooling blood, the fact that there was coagulated blood on the vein, and the fact that he never made a bed in a mile really leads me to believe it was some kind of muscle shot, some kind of partial pass through. And that, to be honest with you, I think the deer's probably fine. Now, he's got, like I said, almost 60 cameras in that area. So I'm just waiting for the text one of these days that Slick showed back up on camera, but I haven't got anything yet. And he might have just booked it right out of the area if he had something that catastrophic happen to him. So unfortunately, that is the result. So I've been on, technically, just because that first whitetail hunt wasn't... it was an elk hunt that I just kind of went, you know, whitetail hunting on. I've been on 3 dedicated guided whitetail hunts and I have yet to shoot a buck. So for those of you out there thinking guided hunts are some type of slam dunk and some way to kind of like build up your body count, I disagree. It is, you know, I kill more shit myself than I do when I'm guided. However, I had a blast. Like I want to go back. You know what I mean? I just don't want to, you know, it is a chunk of change, you know? And I think about all the hunts that I can do DIY for that much money. And it's hard to justify, you know, spending that much money again to go do the same thing that I've already done. So yeah, that's my hunt. Now let's get back to the bow. So first of all, I would like to say I really like my RX-7. It shoots like a dream. If you're interested in a more detailed review, go hit up the YouTube video I just posted. I think it's, you know, super informative. I also think what happened with the bow, the epoxy letting go, it truly is a one in a million issue. I've run into maybe two or three other stories of something similar happening. I don't think it's endemic to the Hoyt RX-7. I might change my mind about that the longer this review is posted and the more people that I hear feedback from. But the warranty support from Hoyt has been less than ideal. And I'm not going to go on some big anti-Hoyt rant. I'm still kind of calming down and like trying to figure out what I'm going to do. But my job as a gear reviewer is to share with you the type of, you know, experience you're going to have with products as a retail consumer. So Kellen got in contact with Hoyt. They said, we'll get you an RX. So this happened last Tuesday. It's now Wednesday. It's been 8 days. I still don't have an RA number. The boat hasn't even left my house because you can't ship it back for warranty repair without an RA number. Still don't have an RA number. Finally phoned Hoyt myself on Monday, talked with somebody on the phone, explained the situation. They're like, we'll get you an RA number, but it has to be an authorized reseller. We cannot give an RA number to a retail customer. So I was like, okay, no problem. I'll get Kellen to call you back in. But I'm like, listen, I think we should talk about this. Like, we're clearly acknowledging this is a warranty issue. This is a Hoyt problem, not a me problem. This is not my fault. I didn't fall on the bow. I didn't drive over the bow. I didn't treat the bow poorly. You know, this is clearly a material workmanship, you know, manufacturing defect. And he's like, yeah, I agree. I'm like, so what do we got to do to get me another bow? I'm like, I'm in the middle of my hunting season. I'm supposed to be hunting blacktail the 2 days after I get home. And I have a limited entry draw tag in New Mexico in 4 weeks. And we went back and forth for a couple minutes. And he essentially said, you know, even after talking with his supervisor, there is no way that we are going to do anything like that. You need to ship the bow in. He's like, typical turnaround time is 10 days. Because this is such a weird oddity, he's like, I'm guaranteeing you the engineers are going to want to look at this. And if the engineers want to look at it, it's going to be at least 3 to 4 weeks. So with shipping times, you're looking at 4 to 6 weeks. So I'm like, you're telling me that I just had a manufacturer defect on a bow, like a flagship premium carbon hunting bow. And my hunting season is now potentially over because you're not willing to replace that bow. And he's like, you are correct. So again, I'm not going to go on some big rant. I've really learned after, you know, putting out all these reviews and running this channel for as long as I have, that it doesn't do anybody any good to like berate or rant about companies. But my honest feeling here is that this is not right. You should stand behind your product. And if you're in the middle of a season, there should be a solution out there. And that solution shouldn't be dependent upon the dealer. It was Hoyt's bow, and it's Hoyt's fault that it broke, and they should do something. Now, I'm very fortunate in that a good buddy of mine, Danny, shout out Backcountry Carnivores, is the one who bought my old bow, my Hoyt Prodefiant 34. And I texted him on the way home, and I'm like, you got any archery hunts planned for December and January? He's like, dude, I was just about to text you. He's like, do you need your bow? I'm like, yeah, buddy, I need my bow, man. So I'm supposed to be going over to Danny's later today and pick up my Prodefiant. So my season's not over, but it's like, it's not the point. The point is you're supposed to care about the end consumer and you're supposed to stand behind your product. And I just really feel let down. Like Hoyt's, it's supposed to be, you know, the premium of the premium. Like Hoyt and Matthews are the two big dogs. It's the Nike and Adidas. It's the, you know, insert premium brands here. They're supposed to be the ones you don't have to worry about this kind of stuff with. So I'm pretty disappointed, but I don't know. Like, does this mean I'll never shoot Hoyt again? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. I haven't really made up my mind, but anyways, that is my 2023 guided Saskatchewan archery whitetail. Now, small note, if anybody lives in Saskatchewan, I'm going to be putting in for archery whitetail. So if somebody wants to get together next year and go hunting together, my plan is to like bring the truck out, bring the quad out on a trailer, buy a bunch of feed, bait a bunch of stuff, set up a bunch of cams, you know, scout and watch pictures for the first 4 or 5 days and then get in some stands and sit there for the next 6 or 7 days. So if anybody's got some intel on Saskatchewan or wants to get together and do some hunting, I mean, please get at me, because I think I really want to spend more time there. I had an absolute blast, and I thought it was, dude, I saw lots of moose. I, you know, heard wolves. I saw lots of deer. Like, it was just a really fun experience. So again, quick reminder, if you want in on the Bow of Your Dreams raffle, mindful-reviews.com. If you want to go watch the new review or any other stuff, go head on over to YouTube, check it out. Questions, comments, concerns, let me know. If you could do me a favor and leave a review on your podcast platform of choice, it would be greatly appreciated. And as always, until next time, thank you for tuning in.